MP for Dudley South. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Adam.
Nice to see you. You well?
Not too bad. Bit of a sniffle, but testing regularly and it's definitely not COVID.
That's good news, considering I'm sat opposite you. It's been an interesting week. Discuss.
Well, I think we've had better. I think the last week, obviously, some of the stories that have been in the media and the people will have read in the newspapers, you know, a lot of us are very angry. You know, like a lot of people, I lost members of the family, family friends during lockdowns. You know, to lose someone special is obviously horrifically difficult and painful in any circumstances. But when you're not able to, you know, spend the time you wanted to in their final days, or you're not allowed to mark their lives the way that you normally would, of course, that does add to the pain. So, of course, people are going to be angry when they see other people apparently enjoying themselves.
Do you think that, or would you agree that the people within Number 10 have handled this situation very, very badly?
I think, you know, a lot of things have clearly been done wrong. I think this one that the civil servant obviously sent out the invitations to the bring your own booze event for the people who were still working at Number 10 during the lockdown. I think that's almost mind-numbingly stupid. Clearly, it shouldn't have happened, and clearly, also, the Prime Minister shouldn't have attended.
But it's still the Prime Minister's place of work, his house. Surely, his staff, you know, he employs the staff. Surely, he should be managing them better than he has been.
Well, obviously, the Prime Minister doesn't really employ most of the civil servants. That's not
are sort of directly responsible, I guess.
They are. I mean, obviously, the head of the civil service is the cabinet secretary, and that's where the normal reporting structures, the disciplinary and oversight would be coming from. So it's only in the most strategic of senses in terms of really policy rather than human resource management that obviously you have the Prime Minister heading the civil service. Yes, I mean, obviously, when people think of Number 10, they look at the footage in the news, they think of this Black Door terrace house. Of course, you know, if there was an event happening in my house, it's very unlikely that it would happen without me noticing, or similarly if it happened in my garden. My garden is simply not big enough for people to come and go without knowing more or less exactly what was going on. I mean, Number 10 Downing Street isn't just a house. I mean, it is an enormous office complex. If you look at the aerial photos, I mean, it's practically the size of some industrial estates. It's over three or four floors. I mean, you can absolutely be in one part of the building and not have a clue who's coming and going in next, whether it's VIPs with entourages and security or whether it's anyone else coming and going.
So what you're saying is there could be stuff going on in there that the Prime Minister may not necessarily be aware of?
Wouldn't necessarily, and obviously his flat is now up above number 11. I've never been into the Prime Minister's flats in Number 10 or Number 11. I've been onto the first floor of 10 Downing Street, and even there, you wouldn't know from the first floor of 10 Downing Street what was going on downstairs, mm-hmm. and vice versa, unless they happen to walk past you.
Now, the Prime Minister has given an open apology as part of Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday just passed, that he attended the one event, and at the moment that's all that we can assume that he did attend. But there's obviously been other parties going on which he was either aware of or not aware of. Should it be the Prime Minister's responsibility to be aware of the ongoing activities within that building?
I think it would be very difficult for any Prime Minister to be aware of all of the different teams and their day-to-day activities around Number 10. Obviously, you know, their role is to make sure that the policy is being followed, is to monitor progress on that and delivery. It's not really the man management. Obviously, some of the stories we saw before Christmas did involve some people who may have been working directly within the Prime Minister's team. Now, that is a different position, I think, from a human resources point of view. I think there he does have a bit more of a review, a bit more of a role where he's obviously employing people directly, some of the political staff, but the civil servants, they do have very different structures. And this, of course, is why Sue Gray's investigation is so important in finding out exactly what happened, where and when, who knew what and when. We're expecting that report to conclude probably within the next week or so. And I think that will answer a lot of the questions. And I think that will really clarify really what the position is and what the future holds.
Will it make your life a lot easier the sooner that it is published?
In some ways, I mean, obviously, you know, once it is published, then a lot of us are going to have a decision to make one way or another.
Well, that seems to be the stock answer at the moment. We must wait until Sue Gray publishes her report, which is like, hang on a minute, I can't give you a forthright answer because I don't know the answer myself. But, for example, I mean, we don't know how this is going to turn out. So let's take both sides. If Sue Gray's report says there's nothing untoward being going on, everything's fine, would that be okay for you as far as you're concerned for things to carry on as normal?
I'm not sure about carry on as normal. I think there are some things we've seen where changes clearly need to be made, where things haven't been running the way that you would want them to, particularly, really, in any circumstances. Now, part of that may be explained by, obviously, the particular circumstances people have been operating, like a lot of organisations, obviously with reduced staff and increased workloads. But I mean, Sue Gray, certainly not a patsy. I mean, she's not someone who's just going to deliver good news, what she thinks that people want to hear. I mean, if there's something there to find, I mean, I think you can put money on Sue Gray will find it.
I think there'll be sceptics out there who think, or can she be paid off to give the answer that the government want?
Well, I mean, I think some of her previous reports, you know, in a slightly different role, her previous investigations, I think, have led to the end of the careers of at least two cabinet ministers. So she's not someone who can be relied on to just say, no, it's okay.
We're not comparing apples with apples when you're comparing Damien Green against Boris Johnson, are we?
Well, I mean, Damien Green was effectively the Deputy Prime Minister. So, I mean, that was a fairly senior person. It was probably the minister closest to the Prime Minister at the time. Mm-hmm. So, actually, yes. I mean, and this is, I mean, Sue Gray has done this role really under previous Prime Ministers of really both of the main parties. I mean, she is someone who very much prides her own independence, and I don't think is someone who would want to risk sacrificing that if it meant, I say, swaying what she thought to be the truth. I think she will produce what she sees as a full and honest report, and then it will obviously be up to all of us to read it, consider it, and decide what's appropriate in those circumstances.
If that was the case, why wasn't she first choice to carry out this investigation?
Well, because obviously the Cabinet Secretary is, as I've said, head of the civil service. When the investigation started, it was primarily around events organised within the civil service, and so the head of the civil service, I think, is a logical person to be heading that up. But of course, the circumstances as they developed meant that it wouldn't have been appropriate, because some of the investigations may have actually touched on decisions that he'd made, and so I think he clearly had to recuse himself. He had to separate himself from that, and really put it in the hands of someone who absolutely had absolutely nothing to do with any of this. And as I've said, someone who does have a very strong record of full and independent and impartial investigations.
Let's now look at the opposite effect. And if Sue Gray's report is damning of Boris Johnson and his government, what is the next step? Do we end up seeing 50-odd letters going up to Sir Graham Brady and then we have a leadership election?
Well, and whether it's...
And will one of those be yours?
I mean, it very much depends on what the report says.
If the report is poor,
If the report was extremely damning, I'm not sure that the Prime Minister would wait for the letters to go in. It would be extremely difficult.
Do you not think so? Because perhaps I'm wrong, but he does come across as being somewhat arrogant.
No, I don't think he would. I think there would be a stage before that where the people around him would be saying, look, I mean, there's just no way through this. So I'm not sure it would necessarily go as far as letters if it became clear that the report was that that damning, that it was going to be impossible to continue, impossible to rebuild trust, that he was personally responsible for a number of these decisions, the events, or should have been, then it would be very difficult for him to continue. That's how, I mean, I do think we need to see that investigation, which hopefully will be days away rather than more than, you know, a week or so. And then we can actually take an informed decision whether that's okay on balance, is better for him to continue or is better for him to go.
Because the problem, as I see also, is that in some ways you can say to Sue Gray, take as long as you like and hopefully it'll go out the media and people forget about it. But you know as well as I do, there's new reports of different parties and activities going on, coming out in the papers almost on a daily basis now. So it's almost making a bad situation even worse by rubbing salt into the wounds.
Yeah, I don't think that's what's defining the timeline. I mean, having spoken to the Prime Minister about this immediately after PMQs on Wednesday, I know that he's expecting the report hopefully to be in the coming week. He hasn't got a clue what's in it. I certainly don't have a clue what's going to be in it, but very much expecting this report sooner rather than later. Now, it may be that if there's some bombshell splash on Monday or Tuesday of next week, that she may decide she wants another day or two to look at that to make sure it's a comprehensive investigation. But no, I think we're expecting it soon.
Do I take it the fact you spoke to the Prime Minister after the PMQs that you're very much on his side?
No, it's because I was having lunch and he came round.
Nice try, Adam. But if it was one of those where it was perhaps a 50-50 report and there were mistakes made and perhaps, you know, some things weren't as bad as perhaps the media making them out to be, and we'll touch on the media in a little while. But if it was one of those where you can see a couple of ways, would you stick with what you've got?
It depends what it does say, because yes, I mean you're right. There are clearly costs with having a leadership change as well. I mean, we're talking 4 months or so whilst a new leader of the Conservative Party would be elected. I think quite quickly, you know, given obviously the challenges we still have with getting through the remaining stages of this pandemic, with then rebuilding the economy, obviously jobs and investment in terms of catching up within health services, within education, all of these are big, big tasks. And that's before you start looking at some of the issues around tackling, say, the illegal channel crossings and any number of big, big challenges that would always be taking up a lot of government time. I think quite quickly some people would see it as quite self-indulgent, even people who are currently demanding change. I think people would see it as quite self-indulgent if we then took 4 months at the moment to effectively decide who we want to be the next Prime Minister. So I think we do have to balance that with whether, you know, what the reports have said, whether the Prime Minister can realistically carry on, whether he's going to be able to rebuild trust after this. And at the moment, to say, having not seen the report, I don't know what the answer is to that.
So there's sort of two points to take out of that. I saw an interview with former Minister Anne Widdecombe during the course of the week where she said exactly the same that you've just said, that there's too many things going on at the moment in order to have a change of leadership. We've got a cost of living crisis, we've got the ongoing Brexit conversations going on, trying to sort Northern Ireland out, we've got foreign issues potentially on our doorsteps as well, we've got the end of the pandemic and so on and so forth. There are too many things going on to bring about a change of leadership. But at the same point, I would argue, well, you know, you say 4 months to change a leader. Does that not mean that there's something wrong perhaps with that process, that it actually takes 4 months to be able to appoint a new leader in the first place?
Well, you'd obviously have either the Prime Minister will continue until a new leader of the Conservative Party was elected and presumably invited to form a government by by the Queen, or you know, if he stood down immediately, then they'd have to have some form of interim Prime Minister. I don't think either of those are an ideal situation. It doesn't mean you can't have a change of Prime Minister, but it does mean you obviously need to understand the consequences and the costs that go with that as well, and that it's something you have to go through with your eyes wide open rather than a decision you take because we are very angry with what we've seen.
Interesting how perhaps this may have affected you personally, I suppose, in your day-to-day stuff, because you are obviously be in contact with people within your constituency and surrounding constituencies. I think Suzanne Webb has said during the course of the week that the people of Stourbridge are more interested in what's going on with you know, cost of living and whatever. But have you sort of tried to, if anyone sort of tries to have this conversation with you about Boris Johnson and his future, do you sort of say, well, hang on a minute, this isn't the most important thing that's going on here, you know, we've got to look at the bigger picture?
I wouldn't put it in those terms, because, of course, I say a lot of us are angry. This is important to many of us. What I would say is it's not a decision I think we should, say, take as a snap decision. We should take on a considered basis as to what is going to be in the interest of the country over the coming months and years, rather than what is good for headlines over the next couple of days.
Is it all about headlines? The reason I say that is because if you'd run this story about 40 or 50 years ago, there was only a couple of TV channels. Perhaps a lot of this could have been hidden away, and you'd have had some stuff perhaps in the papers, but that is as far as it goes. Does the media now play a huge effect in perhaps people's decisions and how they view people like Boris Johnson?
Well, obviously the media does, social media does. We get our information from any number of sources now. That wasn't the case, you know, if you think back to the days of John Profumo and Profumo scandal, where the mainstream media didn't touch that because that wasn't really how politics was covered at that time. Now, I don't think we want to go back to those days, but yeah, clearly both media and informal media like social media do have a huge role in shaping how things like this are viewed, how the debate is framed, and have a big impact on people's futures, for better and for worse.
Is there any one thing that would sort of push you over the edge? Or do you just look at it as a whole and you'll just wait for the report and you'll say, OK, on balance, I'll make my decision based on how I see the report as a whole rather than one particular thing?
I don't know about one particular thing, but, you know, clearly it will be important what she concludes in terms of what the Prime Minister knew and what he did throughout all of this. As I said at the start, I think, you know, some of these mistakes that were made, it's hard looking back at them to work out what on earth people were thinking to decide that that was appropriate at the time. We don't really know. Obviously, Prime Minister gave his very short statement ahead of Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. We don't really know what the Prime Minister knew, what his level of involvement in any of this really was throughout, and I think that's something that the report will help to clarify.
Do you think the Alexis Stratton thing made things perhaps 100 times worse, because it sort of brought out that the people behind Boris in Downing Street were, you know, almost trying to cover things up? They knew what was going on, but it was almost done in a jokey kind of way, and perhaps anybody, as you rightly say, who have lost anybody during the pandemic would look at that and think, you know, how dare they, you know, behave the way that they are. It's almost like childlike in many respects.
Of course. I mean, I was angry when I saw that, and I know a lot of other people will have been at all. Now, we know that a lot of the stories that have been coming out, they've been very strategically placed by certain former disgruntled former advisor within Downing Street. He's doing this quite deliberately to cause as much damage as possible. That doesn't mean that you can obviously discard what is emerging, but I think you do have to understand it within a certain certain context, and I think that's why Sue Gray's report will help to place that in the context of actually what was it that was happening, rather than a few snapshots that certainly shouldn't have happened, but may or may not have been representative of wider behaviour.
It reminds me actually of the expenses row, which I think was drip-fed a few years ago into the papers, and one by one, I think various ministers were sort of caught up in that, and it's albeit that was probably 5, 6, 7 years ago now. But
I'm afraid it was nearly 13 years ago.
Was it really? Gosh, I am. I
think it's slightly different in that the Telegraph had all of the information about that in one go. They were sent the CD with all the information on it, and then they published one thing after another every day. Whereas I think what we're seeing now is fairly familiar pattern. On a Sunday night or a Monday, you see a very vague story appearing, normally in the broadcast media, but sometimes in the Sunday papers. That's then followed up the next day. There's then a blurry photo emerges some point on Tuesday, and then just before Prime Minister's questions on the Wednesday morning, the full details of documentary evidence, leaked emails or whatever come out just before PMQs to make sure it's another day's news story. You then have obviously the reporting of what happened in Parliament on the back of that, and it guarantees every week that there's 4 or 5 days coverage for every story that comes out. It's been done extremely effectively. I mean, if you're looking at it from a media management point of view, it is a huge amount of skill in keeping this going and drip feeding it the way that it is. Obviously the question people, including members of Parliament, are obviously asking is, okay, so what we know and we see, and obviously we're angry about, but we're also worried about what we may not yet have seen, what is still to come. And that's, I think, one of the other things we're looking for Sue Gray to be looking at, obviously having had access to much more of the documentation, the communications, obviously having interviewed people potentially involved, just trying to work out, okay, so is this it? Is there more? Is there things that may be more incriminating? And I think that would make a big difference.
Well, that's the thought. If there's any more that comes out after Sue Gray's report, does that change anything?
Well, I think it would obviously, depending on the nature of what came out after Sue Gray's report, it would obviously raise questions as to how honest people had been with the investigation. And I think that would obviously be a huge issue, whether that's for civil servants, whether it's for officials, or whether it's for politicians and political staff. If people haven't been honest with Sue Gray, if they have been misleading her, I think that would be a very serious issue.
A couple of emails. Thank you guys for sending your emails in. Keep them coming if you would do, please. Neil in Warheath says, does Mr Wood feel that all of the hysteria around Partygate starts to impact on positive work our MPs are doing locally? I voted for Mike and he's done some great things for Dudley South, and I worry the public forget the local representation and tar them all with the PM's brush.
Well, I think that is an issue. I mean, I think it distracts away from some of the important work that's been done nationally as well by the government, as well as work that hopefully I'm doing and other local MPs are doing, and of course work that local councillors and other people who are working in the community are doing. And you certainly wouldn't want that to be disregarded because of stories that are appearing about events that shouldn't have happened during the pandemic.
Mary from King Swinford says, does Mike agree that the moment the Labour backbencher, I forgot his name, broke down in tears, really humiliated the situation and changed the rhetoric in Parliament? I think it's Jim Shannon that you're referring to.
Yeah,
Mary.
So Democratic Unionist Party, Northern Ireland MP rather than a Labour MP. I mean, that was heart-wrenching, and I think particularly so because so many people could identify with the emotion he was clearly going through. I know Jim well. I mean, he's a lovely guy, as honest as they come. It doesn't mean we agree on absolutely everything, although we probably agree on more than we disagree. But I think there's no question that he was suffering as he was asking that question and revisiting a lot of the emotional pain he went through at the time.
Looking at, I mean, we go back to social media and a lot of these companies put out surveys as to what you think should happen and are you happy and whatever. One thing that I've found, and indeed Black Country Radio have done exactly the same, which I thank Dan for sending me a link to, it's not clear cut. It's probably 50-50 as to those who actually are against Boris and want him removed. And what potentially might be the opposite effect is having Keir Starmer as Prime Minister instead. So it's a lot of people sort of prepared to forgive, but they want things to improve.
Yes, I mean, I think there is an element of that. Now, of course, there are some people who have been angry at Boris Johnson since well before he became Prime Minister, you know, going back to the EU referendum nearly 6 years ago. Other people have been angry at him because either he introduced any restrictions at all during the pandemic. Other people have been angry because the restrictions didn't go far enough and there was some blame there. And of course, many of us are angry at some of the reports we've seen over the past month or two. And of course, there are some people who fall into more than one of those categories that there is overlap. But similarly, I think there is a recognition that if Boris Johnson was to resign this afternoon, he wouldn't suddenly be replaced with somebody's ideal Prime Minister tomorrow. For those people who wanted Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister 2 years ago and still want him to be Prime Minister, Jeremy Corbyn's not going to be Prime Minister tomorrow. Similarly, you know, we don't know what really comes next. You know, what we do know is that we have to, you know, complete the journey out of this pandemic. If there was a change of leadership, it would be very disruptive. But similarly, obviously, if it was found that that the Prime Minister's behaviour had breached standards, the rules that we're setting to such an extent, he couldn't continue, couldn't rebuild that trust. And so the cost of replacing the Prime Minister would probably be less than the harm caused if he was to continue having had a very, very critical independent report.
Paul in Norton says, "What I like about Mike is what appears to be humility, a sentiment seemingly shared by Jack Dromey, not my party, but a hugely influential local MP."
Yes, and obviously extremely sad to have lost Jack Dromey at the end of last week. I did quite a lot of work with Jack over the last 6.5 years, particularly on police issues when I did my private member's bill around compensation during riots. I think he was shadow minister for part of that, so did a lot of work with him on that, but also on a lot of West Midlands issues, particularly around manufacturing sector, the automotive supply chains. Obviously, he does a lot of work with JLR in particular, and he's going to be extremely sadly missed across all parts of the House of Commons, but of course particularly by his wife Harriet Harman and their family.
We touched on the issues that would face an incumbent Prime Minister if that ends up being the case, and one of those is the cost of living situation. Now, we know that wholesale gas prices and their increase recently are here to stay at least for 2 years by the looks of things, which is going to be very difficult for people on low incomes and who rely on help from the state. We've also got a national insurance increase coming in at the beginning of April to help with social care. I mean, these are worrying times for people without much money.
Of course they are, and I met with the Chancellor on Wednesday night to talk about energy bills in particular and obviously what support might be able to look at to help those people who are only just about managing at the moment, for whom, you know, what could be very large increases in energy bills would have the biggest impact, because I mean, I think some wholesale energy prices, I think, have increased around tenfold. If you scale that up across the the UK, what it could mean is total energy bills in the UK increasing by around £15 to £20 billion this year. And as you've said, that could stay the case for 3 or 4 years. It's probably not just going to be a six-month spike because of the global factors that are driving this, the increased demand for energy as parts of the world come out of this pandemic, but at the same time, still very low levels of production, high levels of reliance on particularly natural gas from Russia coming into Europe. All of these are putting big pressures on household and industrial energy costs. Now, £15 to £20 billion, that it's not really the kind of money that government can then cover and, you know, cushion everybody against. I mean, that's, if you take the top end of that figure, that's roughly the amount that central government spends on police, prisons and the court service combined. So unless you were talking about taking away that kind of level of service or absolutely enormous increases in taxation, which would obviously make things more difficult for more people, because I think it'd be lazy to imagine you can just say, oh well, someone else will pay for it, it'll be someone considerably richer than you are. So we have to face up to the fact that yes, there are going to be a lot of people for whom their electricity and gas bills will be a lot higher. So we need to look at what support can the government provide. Should it look at something very broad and shallow? So as you may know, the Labour Party were, and some of the media are, campaigning for VAT to be suspended on energy, which would be a 5% reduction. Now, 5% reduction in energy bills, if your bills are going up by 40, 50%, is obviously nice to have. But for a lot of the people who are going to be hardest hit, it will not be enough to stop them really, really going over the edge and really struggling. So you either have that broad and shallow support, or you decide, no, we should try to target at where it is needed the most so that those people can have more support that might really make that difference. And then, of course, you have to decide, okay, so where does that need to be targeted? Because it's not necessarily the people who are currently receiving benefits and pension credits, although they may need it, but the people who are just above that threshold may also desperately need that support. And that's the kind of discussions we're having at the moment, what I was talking to the Chancellor about on Wednesday night, and what I know the Treasury are looking at the moment. Because yes, I'm with the review in the energy price cap, which has helped to keep the bills lower than they otherwise would be. We know that there are now only a few energy companies that are able to continue at that level. The price cap, because of the increases in wholesale prices, is probably going to have to increase, I think, this spring. So we are going to need the extra support to stop people really being put in a position where they can't be heating and powering their homes.
Universal credit?
Yeah, so, I mean, universal credit, obviously the taper rate on universal credit that was announced in the budget, that's the 8p reduction in what's called the withdrawal rate. So you can now be earning more before you lose your universal credit. I mean, that's worth up to £2,000 for some families. That came into operation just before Christmas, and I think that's a big step forward.
But there was obviously an increase, albeit on a temporary basis, in universal credit. You wouldn't say that perhaps because of these extenuating circumstances such an increase should be reintroduced?
Well, obviously, universal credit, like other benefits, will increase as normal, depending on inflation. So that'll be reviewed. But that £20 temporary uplift at the start of the pandemic, and that really wasn't ever intended to be a permanent increase. It was largely introduced to bring universal credit in line with statutory sick pay, because some of the eligibility for statutory sick pay made it difficult for people to qualify at the start of the pandemic. If they tested positive, or they had to be off work because of COVID. So because sick pay was £20 higher than universal credit, there wasn't time to change the law on eligibility for sick pay. So what they did was they introduced a temporary increase in universal credit to bring the two in sync. I don't think that would have happened if there had been a feeling it had to be permanent.
So I suppose what you're saying is it's going to be difficult times, which perhaps we haven't yet come across because of the fact that we had such a mild autumn and up to Christmas. But I suppose there isn't an awful lot you can do. Now we're getting into the colder months and people are going to find it more difficult going forward. There's only so much help the government can give based on what you're saying.
And we obviously have to be honest about the limitations of what can be done. But similarly, there is cause for optimism with the economy. We know that there are now 400,000 more people in employment, so as employees, than there were 2 years ago ahead of the pandemic. Yesterday's economic figures show the economy is now back to where it was 2 years ago at the start of the pandemic. So as it looks like we're going to be able to open up more quickly than really anywhere else in Europe. Most other major economies in the Northern Hemisphere, the World Health Organization, say they expect the UK to be able to open up more quickly and better than really anywhere else in the Northern Hemisphere. I think that is what we need to get the economy going so that we're creating the jobs, so people have got the extra productivity, so wages can go up to try and meet these increased costs.
But I suppose we're going to go full circle with the fact that there's never been more vacancies than what there are now, but they're not being taken.
I mean, there's certainly a big issue with making sure that we match people who are looking for work with the people who've got vacancies that need to be filled. But I don't think we can have a situation where people can choose not to work because benefits are there. I don't think that's how the welfare system ought to work. It ought to be a safety net rather than something that's available as an option.
Mm. Okay, let's just again on the subject of gas, and this time I'm going to talk about Russian pipelines and how much of an effect that might be an issue as well. Should we be in a situation where Russia decide to go into Ukraine, we impose sanctions on Russia, and Russia say in turn, well, I'm sorry, but we're going to cut off your gas. Is that potentially an issue going somewhere down the line?
Well, obviously the UK isn't particularly reliant on Russian gas directly. Most of the Russian gas goes through continental Europe. Most of our gas, as I understand it, is Norwegian gas, but where it does obviously make the difference is that if Russia hugely reduces its supply of gas, then because gas is a commodity on international markets, if there's a lot less supply, then the Norwegian gas will become more expensive because of demand exceeding the amount of gas available. And so it's our prices that go up, even though we're not buying the gas that's being withdrawn.
Okay. And just on the subject of what's happening abroad at the moment, obviously there's a worrying times, and particularly with what's going on with Russia and Ukraine. You've also got North Korea setting off ballistic missiles again. And you've got China, who is sort of infiltrating MPs and trying to influence things in Parliament this end as well. How much of this is a worry to you?
Well, I think all of these are concerns. I mean, I'm a member of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is the international body that looks at particularly security issues, also democracy and human rights issues in the wider Europe and Atlantic region. And Ukraine, obviously Russia effectively invaded a large portion of Ukraine a number of years ago. They supported the annexation of parts of South Crimea, and there are worrying signs that that Russia is considering further encroachments within what is the sovereign territory of an independent country. I mean, that's a really worrying trend for those of us who grew up at the time of the Cold War, who thought those days were behind us in the late 80s, early early 90s.
Well, you just wonder whether Ukraine will be the end of it, whether they'll try and take back countries like Latvia and Lithuania and other ex-Soviet states and turn them, you know, almost get the old Soviet Union back together.
Well, obviously, Ukraine wasn't the first country that Russia took this kind of expansionist approach into. You look at the activities around, for example, Georgia before Ukraine.
Yes,
and, so, given that Ukraine wasn't the first, it's almost certainly not going to be the last. We also obviously have to be honest enough to accept that we're unlikely to, America's unlikely to, NATO is unlikely to be looking at something that involves large numbers of troops in Central Europe that could trigger World War III for very obvious reasons. And so the amount of levers we actually have, whilst we're supporting some of these countries in terms of the technology and sharing security and intelligence information, the amount we can do directly is probably limited. We know that obviously the Russian armed forces are amongst the biggest and most heavily equipped in the world, and in a straight fight they'd probably be successful in military action in most areas of the world, at least on some level, and so it's obviously we have to try and avoid that. We have to use what diplomatic and economic levers we have available rather than relying purely on military options.
Of course, there are sanctions which could be placed, which again could heighten tensions even further. I mean, just in a few words, how worried are you about the situation?
I'm not worried in terms of the direct security implications in the UK. I am worried in terms of the regional geopolitical security in particularly Central Europe and some of our international allies. I think actually the threat from China is probably a more direct threat at the moment in the United Kingdom. And as you've referred to, the revelations that a solicitor in Birmingham has actually been identified as someone who's been seeking to influence some parliamentarians on behalf of the Chinese state, who we know have been responsible for some horrific human rights resources in their own country. They're also destabilising the Pacific region, some of our Commonwealth partners, and that we've got a former shadow minister who appears to have taken £500,000, employed this, well, for want of a better word, Chinese spy's son for several years. You've got a former cabinet minister, current leader of one of the opposition parties, who, whilst he was energy secretary, appears to have taken £5,000 from people with links to the Chinese state. I mean, these are, I think, questions that have to be addressed.
Yeah, yeah. The MP in question, apparently... somebody said they didn't think he'd be able to afford Savile Row suits on his normal MP's salary, so they wondered where the money perhaps had come from. But it is a worrying time. And there does seem to be a link that this lady in question has seemed to sort of got more into the Labour Party than any of the other parties. She's been pictured, albeit with David Cameron, I've seen her pictured.
She's an effective network. I mean, I think she's had her photo taken with an awful lot of people. I think you'll find photos. Yes, I mean, out of the, I think it's supposed to be nearly £600,000 that they've channeled one way or another, almost all of it went to one single former shadow minister, who I should say I don't think has received money directly and personally. I'm not sure he's been paying for his suits. I think it has been funding his funding his office, but I think there are risks and issues involved there, even if it wasn't for direct personal
use. Well, at best, he's been naive, hasn't he?
I think that's fair. I think even if he had no reason to assume she was working directly on behalf of the Chinese government, I think it is reasonable to say questions should have been raised and red flag. Sorry, red flags is probably the wrong word to use in the circumstances. Should have been triggered when there's that level of money going through a middle-ranking shadow minister's office. I think people are naturally going to ask, what were they expecting in return?
But if it were you, if you've got MI5 knocking on your door and saying, "Oh, you want to be a bit careful about this person," I'm guessing you'd take their advice and say, you know, you keep your distance.
Of course. I mean, I think any of us would. And obviously, when this story broke, was it only yesterday lunchtime? I think obviously the son of this apparent agent did leave the shadow minister's employment more or less immediately. So yeah. I mean, I think once it was clear that there was an issue, it was. That part of it was resolved quite quickly. But yes, I think you're right. There was a certain naivety. There will clearly need to be investigations in terms of, okay, what benefit could the Chinese state have got in return for what was apparently, you know, £500,000 of investment in this MP's
office.
Yeah,
but they were going to put money into the nuclear power station, weren't they? So, or jointly help fund that. So I suppose maybe that's the fallout of it?
Yeah, possibly. So I think this was obviously funding staff to work in a shadow minister's office, is my understanding. But I mean, this is obviously something the security forces will need to look at rather than me and you speculating on the media.
What, me speculate? Never. Mike, if you don't mind, we're going to keep you just for 3 or 4 minutes beyond the other side of the news, because we're nearly 11 and I want to talk about the Commonwealth Games, which you're very much involved with. Which is coming up in July. It seems to come around very quickly, hasn't it?
It has. It seems no time at all since Durban announced they weren't going to be able to stage it after all, and Birmingham stepped in. And back then, I think we were about 3 years away from the Games, and you think there's, you know, loads of time, whereas now it's 6 months.
And I guess at one time we thought it wasn't going to take place or might be pushed back like the Olympics because of the pandemic as well.
Yes, whereas now it looks like this will be probably the first big multi-sport international event held in the world after the pandemic, other than the Winter Olympics, will be on a rather different scale, I think, this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this will be the first one that operates in a way that most people would recognise as normal.
So we'll talk about the Commonwealth Games, the other side of the news at 11. Thanks for the moment, Mike. And then after that, we'll be talking to Zilla Amaran Brown, who's from the Canal and River Trust, talking about the funding that they've been receiving or about to receive from Sport England as part of the Commonwealth Games, basically how the money's going to be spent to improve our canals and waterways, something, again, I know Mike's very keen on as well, and very, very much pretty involved with as well. So lots to talk about. Also, a quick catch-up with what's going on at the War Memorial Ground this afternoon, a 1:30 kick-off, and apparently the game is on as Stourbridge host Guiseley in the FA Trophy, looking to make progress in the same way that Kidderminster Harriers did in the FA Cup last week. Congratulations to them. They, of course, host West Ham United in the fourth round of the FA Cup at Agbara. Right, it's 11 o'clock, time for the news headlines. Black Country Radio. And it's 11 o'clock.
From the Sky News Centre at 11, Labour's piling pressure on the Prime Minister to resign after more reports of parties at Downing Street during lockdown.
We're witnessing every day the broken spectacle of a Prime Minister mired in deceit and deception and unable to lead. But whilst the Tories bicker and fight each other on WhatsApp, I want to look to the future.
Sir Keir Starmer's accused Boris Johnson of being too preoccupied defending his rule-breaking to lead the country. The latest allegations suggest staff were encouraged to let off steam during weekly wine time Friday events. Well, tennis number one Novak Djokovic has returned to a detention hotel in Melbourne after his visa was cancelled for a second time. He's appealing the decision with the aim of being able to compete in the Australian Open from Monday. US Open champion Emma Raducanu thinks other aspects of the sport deserve attention too.
I feel that it has taken away a little bit from the great tennis that's been happening over this summer in Australia. For example, Andy Murray, I mean, he's in the final tonight, which I think is pretty incredible to see him come back and win and play so well.
Prince Andrew's former assistant may have to give evidence as part of the lawsuit against him. The Duke denies sexual assault allegations, but his accuser's lawyers have applied to courts here for permission to interview two people in the UK. Actor Alec Baldwin's turned over his iPhone to the investigation into a fatal movie set shooting. Police looking into Helena Hutchins' death have been trying to get hold of it since last month. Andy Murray has missed out on a first ATP Tour title since 2019. He suffered a straight sets defeat in the final of the Sydney Tennis Classic, losing to top seed Aslan Karatsev. And England's cricketers have given themselves some hope of saving the final Ashes test on day two against Australia. A short time ago, their hosts were on 23 for 2, a lead of 138 runs. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.
Thank you, Kat. It's Adam Parks with you on Black Country Week at 2 minutes past 11 on this Saturday morning. And don't forget, after 12 o'clock, Dan Richards is here. Mike Wood, MP for Dudley South, is with me. Mike, I know you've got a particular keen interest in the cricket. That's one bit of good news in the space of 2 months, I guess.
Well, I mean, 2 wickets are better than no wickets. It's still a lot of work to do, I think, to try and win this test.
Do you sort of look and think, where have we gone wrong and what can we do right?
I don't think many England fans had a huge amount of confidence going into this Ashes series, but I think the manner in which the batting has repeatedly collapsed, I think, is it is worrying. I mean, these are supposed to be some of the best batsmen in the world. Obviously, you put them in a different form of the game with limited overs, and some of them are the highest ranked batsmen anywhere, and yet, you know, with a red ball and white cricket whites on, and suddenly they struggle to make more than a handful of runs, and it's match after match.
Let's talk about different sport now. Commonwealth Games just around the corner, as we mentioned just before the news. You're on a committee, aren't you, in Parliament? Just explain what that's all about.
Yeah, so I chair the all-party parliamentary group on the Commonwealth Games, which is obviously working with the organising committee, also with different sports bodies, and looking at a number of the issues around Commonwealth Games, and with us obviously hosting those games in Birmingham this July and August. There's, you know, a huge amount of work we've been doing on supporting things like the volunteer recruitment program last summer, some of the environmental work that's been being done that you referred to, and I know Zilla's coming on to talk about later, but also obviously how we can make sure that the games leave a lasting legacy for not only for Birmingham City but also for the wider West Midlands.
I mean, what are the sort of things that you sort of had to take into account? I mean, obviously, you want to put Birmingham on the map in the same way that London did with London 2012, Glasgow did to a certain extent in the Commonwealth Games in 2014. I know you said off air before you'd like to have been invited to the Gold Coast, but you didn't get the opportunity in 2018. But it is all about legacy and what you leave behind, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I still remember as a 10-year-old schoolboy, a primary school in Stourbridge, you know, gathering around a rather small television as the International Olympic Committee were about to announce, as it turned out, that Barcelona had got the 1992 Olympics rather than Birmingham. And so we've had to wait a further 30 years for a major multi-sport international event to come to what's obviously Britain's second city and come to our region, and we have to make sure that we take advantage of the opportunities it provides for local people, for local businesses, and then obviously how we make sure that it has a sporting legacy as well after the Games have closed in August.
And to a certain extent, I suppose, the money that's being given out by Sport England to encourage activity is important money to try and get people involved who might otherwise not be interested.
Yeah, so obviously Sports England are distributing money they get from the government and from the National Lottery, and a big part of that focus is on engagement, and some of it is directly in sport, and obviously grassroots sports, getting people involved who may not have played sport regularly, or young people, getting them involved in organised sport for the first time. But part of it is more informal support, supporting community events and projects. So some of their funding, I think, around play areas as well, that I'm hoping we may be able to benefit from in parts of Dudley South as well. And I think all of this helps to build on that legacy and make sure that Birmingham 2022 isn't just about those couple of weeks in July and August with the many, many sports that are on offer, but actually it leaves some lasting benefits for the, say, particularly the wider West Midlands and for us in the Black Country.
In a way, London 2012 came at a good time because of the fact that we were coming out of the other side of a difficult sort of economic situation. In a way, we're in exactly the same boat, and that we're coming out of a pandemic. I feel that perhaps these Commonwealth Games are going to be welcomed by the public with open arms.
Yeah, I mean, it looks as though they're going to be the first major international multi-sport event really to be operating as normal, because I don't think the Winter Olympics are going to be going the way that you'd normally expect a Winter Olympics to, and that's not only because they're in Beijing. I think, you know, there will be number of restrictions. They won't be as open to the public, and the way that the athletes won't be participating in the way that you normally would in a Winter Olympics. But hopefully in Birmingham by the end of July, we'll have the national teams from around the Commonwealth, based around the country. We'll obviously have what look like being full stadiums for many, many of the events. Certainly, you know, as someone who's tried to be getting tickets unsuccessfully through the two ballots so far, it appears that demand is very, very high, certainly for the athletics, for the swimming, for the cycling, and many other the other sports. And so we have lots of people coming together watching sports they love, really for the first time in a long time. And I think as we hopefully are coming out of the pandemic, I think that's going to do us all an awful lot of good.
We're a sport-loving nation anyway, and I think London 2012 proved that by the very fact that I think for the first Olympics ever, like, morning sessions of the athletics and the swimming were sold out, and although there may have only been minor events going on or heats or whatever, that they were played to capacity crowds. And the same happened at Hampden Park for the athletics in Glasgow, and at Tollcross for the swimming as well in Glasgow as well in 2014. You know, the Brits and the Aussies, for that matter, both countries love their sport, and the public very much get behind it, and it creates that kind of atmosphere that you want to be part of.
We all want to see Adam Peaty win more gold medals this summer at the Aqua Centre in Smethwick. You know, we want to see Dina Escher-Smith come back after that, you know, the heartbreak of the injury at the Olympics, to really run away with the field in the athletics at the Alexandra Stadium. You know, there are, for that matter, you know, we're going to have the cycling road races coming through Dudley. We're going to obviously have the marathon around Birmingham, a lot of the West Midlands triathlon going out. There are a lot of free events so that even people without tickets will be able to see some of this world-class international sport right on our doorstep this summer.
One of the first big outside broadcasts we did as a station when it was its original name was from the Black Country Museum during the London Torch Relay. And I remember then, because it came through the museum itself, but we were also watching the TV at the time and watching where it was on the pictures, and to see, like, streets, like Birmingham New Road, like, for example, being lined with people wanting to watch the baton even. You know, if we can create the same for something like that, then you know you're in for a fantastic Commonwealth Games. And I know that there's opportunities available now for people to get involved with actually carrying the baton for a certain amount of time.
Yes, so the Queen's Commonwealth Baton Relay, it's the equivalent of the Olympic torch. The Queen puts a message to the Commonwealth inside the baton. That then left Birmingham Airport, I think, in October. It's got a 9,000-mile journey around the Commonwealth. It's doing every single Commonwealth country and territory before it comes back to the UK just before the Games. So we essentially get it for the month leading up to the Games. We know it'll be coming around the West Midlands. It's coming around all seven boroughs in the West Midlands. So we'll certainly be having legs of the route coming through Dudley, and there is that opportunity, just as we had some really great local torchbearers in 2012, carrying it through places like the Black Country Museum. We're looking for people to nominate local heroes who should be carrying the Queen's Relay Baton when it's coming through the West Midlands next July. We need 2022, appropriately enough, from England. And I want as many of them as possible to be from Dudley. So if we've got people who may have made a massive difference in, say, community grassroots sport, people who really contributed to their communities in other ways, it may be community organisations, it may be education, the arts and culture, it may be some of our COVID heroes with health. You know, there are any number of reasons why people may be nominated to be one of these baton bearers. So we want as many as possible being put forward through the Commonwealth Games website so that we can recognise our local heroes and involve them in what should be the experience of a lifetime ahead of our home Commonwealth Games.
It's great. I mean, there are lots of local heroes, and I'm sure people out there will know people who perhaps are worthy of carrying the baton and they can be nominated. But how do you go about nominating somebody to do that?
Well, the nominations have now opened. I'm just trying to find it on the Birmingham 2022 website, because I haven't actually copied the link for the baton bearers. But the website is birmingham2022.com, and people can. There's a very prominent link on the homepage there to nominate a baton bearer, and you just fill in the form. There you explain why these people are so special, why they should be baton bearers. So they're looking for people who, you know, people who may be always willing to take on challenge, people with unique stories, say contributions to community, or they may just be really inspiring figures locally. And as you say, we've got loads of these around the Black Country. I mean, we've got people like Kev Dillon Lions Boxing Club and Black Country Blokes Mental Health Podcast. Obviously, Blind Dave Healy operating out of Sandwell. But we've got so many of these in all of our communities, who are really inspiring people who we want representing us.
Is a preference for a sporting link for this person, or can it be anybody?
It really can be. It can be anybody. So if it's somebody who's made a real difference, say in for young people in the communities, then that's a great reason to be nominating people. It doesn't need to be about sport. Obviously, a lot of them will be, but it could be education. I say it could be any part of community life.
So that's the Birmingham 2022 website. You say there's a prominent link on the homepage there if anybody's interested in putting their name forward or putting somebody else's name forward. And really the distance that they have to run with the baton, I guess, it just depends on your own health and fitness, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, we're not expecting people to run marathons. I mean, obviously those 2022...
I'll just put your name down in that case.
I mean, those 2022 people around England, many of them will just be carrying it for, you know, a few hundred yards, really. And so I don't think you're expected to be at Olympic pace. You're certainly not expected Olympic distances. But it is about, say, highlighting the incredible people we've got in our in our local communities, whether that's, I say, charity work, whether it's sport, whether it's education, and every other part of community life.
Great, great stuff, and well done for promoting that. And let's hope that we have a brilliant Commonwealth Games. Mike, we've done some overtime with you this morning. Thank you for talking so frankly about everything, and we appreciate and also, of course, we appreciate your input as well from the listeners, your emails as well.